My name is Danielle Mazingo. I attend Campbell University School of Law, and my story is called The Power of Being. In July 2001, law enforcement officers responded to a domestic violence call at approximately 2 o'clock a.m. They pulled into my neighborhood, a small trailer park located a few yards from the highway. I sat outside on my porch steps, and I watched blue lights dance in the summer air. My father left in handcuffs. I vomited from the stress. Anxiety became an integral part of my existence at a young age. I struggled to understand the world around me, a world where I went hungry, where my parents hit each other, and misery followed me. I blamed myself for these things. As I grew older, I realized that my parents suffered from opioid addiction and untreated mental illness. I also came to realize that their struggles with addiction were due, in part, to repeated incarceration without adequate substance abuse treatment. But on this night in 2001, I didn't know what to make of my life. I was just 4 years old. 9 years later, I blew out my candles after a chorus of voices sang "Happy Birthday." I sat down to open my presents, surrounded by family and a few friends. A knock at the door interrupted our festivities, and an officer presented a warrant for my father's arrest. After that day, nothing surprised me anymore. Incarceration became a career in which my parents alternated shifts. I became so accustomed to correctional facilities that it felt like I was in prison too. What was once traumatizing became mundane. The razor wire fences and plexiglass visiting booths didn't really faze me anymore. I walked across the prison yard unfeeling as guards aimed their rifles at me from above the tower. My heart was cold. My father's name is inmate 029-5413. He's been in and out of prison since he was 26 years old. Despite his violent past, he's a sensitive man who loves cats, U.S. history, and cozy sweaters. He has my name tattooed over his heart. He was once my best friend. My mother's name is inmate 0539483. I have known her my whole life, but I didn't meet her until I was 14 years old, when I first saw her sober. Though only 50 years old, she has false teeth after years of drug abuse. She struggles with severe depression, and she uses a walker as she's in need of a hip replacement. She calls me from News Correctional Institution once a month to talk about nothing. We hardly know each other anymore, but I guess we never knew each other to begin with. She often asks how my job is going, a court advocate position at a local domestic violence center. How do I tell my mother that every victim that walks through the door reminds me of her? I can't. Most of the clients I encounter distrust the legal system, and rightfully so. Some are afraid to report their abuse because police have doubted their allegations. Others are afraid their testimony will be discredited because they're addicted to drugs. How do I tell these women in good faith to trust the system when I feel like a victim of it myself? I can't. My work in victims advocacy unveils the oppression shared between my clients and me, a commonality that I have actively ignored in the past just for the sake of getting by. I sit across from them in a tailored pantsuit. I look the part of a middle-class servant, out of touch but with good intentions. And my clients, they look very different from me. Yet we are the same. Though we are strangers, we know each other very well. My existence in this field leaves me feeling like a walking contradiction. Does a pursuit of a legal career imply an inherent trust that I so vehemently deny? Perhaps the most important trust is not given to the institutions or the systems, but to the people within. Life is filled with many beautiful contradictions. I turn to a system which has taken power from me in order to restore the power that has been taken from others. It is a privilege to be trusted with a client's well-being and trauma in her most powerless state. It is a privilege to tell a client that you understand what they're going through and actually mean it. If there is even a small possibility that my work can protect others, the re-victimization I suffer is a cost that is both negligible and necessary. Zealous advocacy is born of zealous empathy. What are we to do when the systems vital to our protection contribute to our oppression? I suppose the answer is different for everyone. For me, the answer is to put down roots in the source of the oppression itself and defiantly make space for myself and others who have felt excluded from its protection. I'm committed to actively engaging with unspeakable trauma so that others may navigate the system with greater ease. To choose otherwise would be an injustice.